ready to go, so we'll take up the matter of Lee Hall Jr. versus Commonwealth. Mr. Powers and Mr. Shandoval. Mr. Powers, you can step on up to the lectern if you would. You have 15 minutes to argue your case. Would you like to reserve any of that time for rebuttal, sir?
Yes, Your Honor, I would. I would like to reserve approximately 4 minutes.
4 minutes? That will be granted, and you may proceed when you're ready.
All right, thank you very much. May it please the court. I'm McMillan Powers, and I do represent Fred Lee Hall, Jr., who was convicted of first-degree murder back in, actually the trial was in January of 2013 for a murder, or at least what we think is a murder that occurred in April of 2011.
Counsel, let me interrupt you and see if we can kind of cut right to the issue here, because we're familiar with the facts.
All right.
Assuming that this was error, why isn't it overwhelmingly harmless, given the rather massive amount of evidence implicating your client in this murder?
Well, that is, of course, the position of the Attorney General, and I recognize that.
Well, it might be a position well taken. It's a pretty strong case, it seems to me.
It is a strong circumstantial case. However, the only piece of evidence that in any way links my client definitively to any part of this crime is this receipt. Now,
whoa,
wait a minute.
Fingerprints all over the place.
There are fingerprints there. He is, however, a person that goes in and out of that house. This is his co-worker. It's not that would be unusual. There's certainly a lot of evidence.
Was it unusual that your client ended up with all these car titles and that the two vehicles that the victim owned were at your client's girlfriend's houses? Was that usual?
All of those circumstances, all of this evidence, damning, certainly paints a bad picture of Mr. Hall. But all of those pieces of evidence have some sort of explanation for them. He was taking the cars to be sold.
But the fact
whether or not anybody believes those, and the trier of fact didn't believe them, but those were all explanations.
But your client's got the paint on him that is used to paint over the blood spatter on the wall. So clearly that ties him to, at a minimum, hiding evidence of the crime, if not the crime itself.
It may. I'm not arguing that. I'm just saying, as to this piece of evidence, when you take all that, the way the evidence unfolds and the way it unfolds in almost every case is there's one piece here and there's one piece there, and it kind of accumulates, and you get a snowballing effect. I understand that, and I know that in this case, the one thing that absolutely nails the door down, as far as the trier of fact was concerned, I'm convinced of this, is this piece of paper.
Mr. Brown, let me ask you a question on that very point.
Okay.
The question before the jury was not by what method, gunshot or crowbar, that Britt was killed, but rather, did your client kill him? Wasn't that the issue for the jury? There was no, it was not firearm related. There was no charge that your client used a firearm in committing the murder or possessed a firearm. The issue before the jury was not, did he shoot him or did he crowbar him to death? The issue was, did he kill him? So what difference does it make? Why do you say that? What difference does it make that this receipt was in evidence? That wasn't an issue for the jury. The issue was simply, did this guy kill this guy?
I agree that's the issue. That's always the issue in the murder case. Uh-huh. Did the defendant, in fact, kill the victim? There are a lot of things going on in this case. First, there is no body. And we have all that. All of these things that come out, no body. There's no one that actually knows the time of death or disappearance exactly. Everything is circumstantial, damning circumstantial evidence perhaps. But when you put together the fact that there is a shell casing of the same caliber classification, a .38 and a 9mm, when you put that shell casing together with this receipt in the mind of the jury, that's enough to push it over the edge.
Your client had threatened the victim with a crowbar, hadn't he, before the victim disappeared?
I think the evidence on that's not really clear as to whether or not there were any threats or what was going on with the crowbar. The fact is that there was some crowbar event sometime in the past.
Yeah.
But whether or not that was actually a threat or whether or not that was an attempt to even an assault or an attempted assault or anything like that.
Just routine crowbar play.
Whatever was going on with that, there was a lot of interplay between these two men. The relationship was obviously dissolving, was obviously going sour. It was headed to a business breakup eventually. All of that's pretty clear in the testimony. But when you get to the one piece of evidence that we believe just pushes everything over, you've stacked all these pieces of evidence up, and you're going to get to beyond reasonable doubt. And that's the tipping point. And without this one piece of evidence coming in, you can't really focus too much on the gun casings or the shells.
Let's assume it had never been offered. All right?
All right.
And you're here arguing sufficiency of evidence in the absence of any receipt.
In the absence of all of this, I would be going uphill. Significantly, which I always do when I'm arguing sufficiency of the evidence.
What you're saying. I'm saying if the receipt had never even been offered in evidence, not part of the evidence, and you were here arguing the evidence, would you be arguing the evidence is insufficient to convict my man of first-degree murder? What would be your argument in those circumstances?
In those circumstances would be the other seven assignments of error that I brought to this court, which were denied.
Well, they're not before us.
And so they're not before us. But that's what I would be arguing. I would be talking about the DNA. I would be talking about other aspects of the case, which I've already done, let us just agree, relatively unsuccessfully, because those issues did not get a writ on them. So those are issues that may later go up to the Supreme Court. I don't know what will happen there, but that's what I would be doing. I would not be focusing on the gun casings and all of that, because the trial would have come out very, very differently. I really believe that it would have been different, a different conclusion, a different kind of issue would have been presented to the jury, because when you take all of this evidence and then you add to it the shell casing, which is found in a plastic bag in the garage, and then you find some ammo, and then you find a receipt for the purchase of the same type of ammunition. Now, that to me is what just really tips everything, and it becomes a very critical part. When you have cumulative evidence, no one piece is enough in the circumstantial case. But
Commonwealth doesn't claim he was shot to death, do they?
They don't claim anything about how he was killed, and that's one of the big problems with the case. But we've got a conviction, so I'm limited there. There's a conviction. Somehow there's a conviction of a man whose body is never recovered. Is that impossible? No, it's not impossible. It's been done before. It happened in this case. But in this case, it seems that the only evidence that clearly links my client to that scene and to those events is this. I mean, it's the one that just really hammers home the problem that the Commonwealth has got with this case. No victim, no murder weapon. And so you've got DNA that doesn't exclude him. You've got some DNA that puts him there. You've got fingerprints that put him there. All of these things add up. But when you get right down to it, it's all about this receipt.
You keep saying that. But there's a whole lot of evidence, as I read the record, tying your client to this scene. What about the paint? What's your comment on that? What about the carpet?
As to the carpet specifically, I don't know if it's the fiber expert, but the trace evidence expert testified that when the carpet was placed there, it was not, she couldn't make it fit. Although the police officer said he thought it fit, the expert said it didn't really fit, And maybe the carpet was from the same unit as the carpet that was in the house at one time. But that evidence was pretty
indefinite. A paint can bearing the appellant's fingerprint was in the garage.
He'd been in that house.
Along with a piece of carpet padding with Britt's blood on it.
He had been in that house before. And so his fingerprints in the house, to me, is not really conclusive.
Maybe he's an accessory after the fact, as opposed to
any sort of thing. He could have been an accessory. We don't know. He may have just been commissioned by the perpetrator. Maybe not as an accessory necessarily that he knew, but just go in and clean up the house.
Driver's license, five of his teeth, bloody clothes, bloody book, cleaning supplies. In the a 9mm cartridge case are found in a trash bag along with a piece of paper related to one of your client's employers or former employer, I'm not sure which. So, I mean, it's true. It's a circumstantial case, as always is, without a body. We don't know exactly what the cause of death is, but what we do know is that the medical examiner testified based on the loss of blood that somebody is dead. In that house, and we've got attempts made to cover up the blood and clean it up that directly tie back to your client, it seems to me. So I guess in terms, you're right, I guess it would be a matter of your point of view as to whether or not one particular piece of evidence makes the difference. It seems to me this particular piece of evidence, this piece of paper, simply noting that ammunition of a certain caliber was purchased at Bob's Gun Shop in Norfolk, whether it's the tipping point or not is sheer speculation, but there's an awful lot of circumstantial evidence that ties your client to this situation. Now, in terms of the law, where we have to kind of look backwards, can you point to a case similar to this that where it was found to be?
I'd be glad to. I'm seeing that my time
yeah,
now
sorry,
is my rebuttal time.
I didn't mean to chew up some of your rebuttal.
That's fine, Your Honor. If you look, I think we've laid out the sequence of cases there, but if you look at in a composite at Clemmer and at Lynch and Prince, and you'll see about this adopted admission concept. One of the things that is clear in the Virginia law is that, and we see this in Lynch, that when it's a written statement, it's an adopted admission if it's signed by the person against whom it is introduced. That doesn't happen here. That's when you boil everything down, that's what we've got. There is no adoptive admission about hearsay documents that are not in the handwriting or signed or some way affirmatively acknowledged by the defendant. That's the way it is. Now, if that changes, it'll change maybe in this case or something, some other case, but that's the state of the law right now. And everything that the Attorney General says about other jurisdictions and what they want the law to be here in Virginia, that's the law right now. It does not exist in this case. He did not sign this document. And we know every time you get a receipt or every time a receipt is manufactured or produced, people do not read those. They don't sign them. We know that. But in the ordinary course of looking at hearsay and in looking at adoptive admissions, the case law in Virginia is clear that if it's going to be used, he has to somehow acknowledge it, and he has not acknowledged that. It's never been acknowledged by him.
Credit card receipts are typically signed, so those would come in, but then
They come in frequently. And look at the other cases that we cited in the brief, talking about text messages where people acknowledge that they sent them or acknowledge that they have an account or acknowledge that that's the way they communicate. When people make some sort of acknowledgement, either verbally or in writing, and affirmatively act, that's an adoptive admission. When it's not an affirmative act, it's not an adoptive. Adoption means you've got to do something. And so that's what we think we have in this case.
I'm going to give you an extra minute in rebuttal.
All right. I would appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chandler.
Please the court. My name is Chris Chandler. I represent the Commonwealth in this appeal. I'd just like to make a few quick points, and then I'll rest on my brief for the remainder of my argument. First of all, to pick up where opposing counsel left off on the hearsay issue, I think it is an open question, very clearly in Virginia, whether this receipt was admissible as an adopted admission, well, regardless of whether it was signed.
I don't want to beat you up too badly here. As a former prosecutor, I got to tell you, when I first read this, I thought this would obviously could have come in as a business record. I mean, there are a number of ways, I guess, to get this thing into evidence. For whatever reason, the prosecutor chose this particular exception to the hearsay rule. And it seems to me the law is pretty clear that for an adoptive admission to exist, you have to adopt something. It requires an affirmative action on the part of someone to take ownership, if you will, of a statement, of a hearsay statement. And we have the case out of the Supreme Court, I don't have it right in front of me, with involving the signed receipt.
Prince.
Here we've got an unsigned receipt, and are you seriously suggesting, as I took from your brief, that simply exercising possession, constructive or otherwise, is enough to adopt as my own admission everything I might ever come in close proximity to?
No, I'm not suggesting that broad of a rule. The rule the Commonwealth is requesting is a rule that simply says that a customer's copy of a receipt, which is retained in his exclusive possession,
how do you know he's
is admissible.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. You say a customer's copy of his receipt. Okay, I agree with you. But how do we know this, that the defendant here was a customer?
Well, I think you can draw that inference from the fact that it was found in his exclusive possession in his car. There's nothing in the record that he owned Bob's Gun Shop. So I think that's that is something that could be argued.
The burden is on the proponent of the evidence, which in this case was the Commonwealth, to establish. You know, we don't draw adverse inferences that way. I mean, it's if you're going to adopt something, you know, again, you say exclusive possession. It's certainly in his car.
Correct.
We don't know if he put it in his car, if a passenger put it there. He never made any statement or took any action that would suggest, or at least let a fact finder draw a reasonable inference that he's taking it as his own statement. He didn't try to return the ammunition, for example, and was denied or something of that nature.
Right. Well, the court did make a factual finding that it was within his exclusive possession. And the car was locked when the officers found the car. And there was no testimony
but
anyone else had access.
But going back to what you say, and I agree with what you say, that a customer's receipt is an adoptive admission. But the leap here is, how do we know this guy was a customer? That's the problem.
Right. I understand where you're coming from. And I think when you're trying to establish that piece of evidence is admissible under the hearsay rule, you just have to prove by preponderance of the evidence the grounds. And I think in order to prove by preponderance of the evidence it's Mr. Hall's receipt, the fact that it was retained in his car, the fact that there was nothing on it.
He had a search warrant for his house, and he had a filing cabinet with obviously all his bank statements and things like that, and he had in there a folder with receipts.
Right.
Then what you're saying is, although it's a car, because of the factual findings of the trial court, it's analogous to that scenario where by placing it in a folder, I mean, that would be maybe a clearer, better example.
Correct.
Placing it in a folder that's clearly his and nobody else's, that's an implicit, rather than with a signature, explicit adoption by the defendant.
Right, and I understand the court's kind of questioning, why didn't we attempt to go the business records exception here? That was my first question as I looked at this case. But when you read through the transcripts, and I think in the prosecutor's closing argument, she mentions the fact that if she had tried to go the business records exception, you couldn't use this receipt. You would have to go to Bob's Gun Shop, try to track down the original receipt, which is a record of that purchase, and then, based on that receipt, I don't think you could get it in, because all that receipt would have memorialized was a purchase made by someone on such and such date. There would be no link to Mr. Hall, so there would be no relevance.
Why
couldn't
you link up that business record then to this receipt found in this car?
That might have made the evidence stronger if you try to make the link.
Judge McCullough and I wrote down from Fredericksburg together yesterday, and suppose we'd stopped at McDonald's, and I got a hamburger, and he got a chicken sandwich, and I left the receipt in the car.
Right.
That's all we got. Who got the hamburger? Who got the chicken?
Well, if it was in the record, that there was any reason to believe.
Car.
Right. If there's any reason to believe in the record that two people have been in that car, then I think that would take that case beyond the scope of the rule we're asking for here, because there's a factual finding he was in exclusive possession of that receipt found in his car.
I think where your argument breaks down, at least as far as I'm concerned, is with each you have to look at each document. I mean, we're talking about a hearsay statement, so the question is, what is the statement that is being propounded here?
Right.
You know, what is the declaration being made, if you will? In this case, it's the purchase of ammunition on a certain date. Mm-hmm. And the receipt itself does not indicate by whom. There's no signed signature as if it were a credit card transaction or that sort of thing. So we don't know in and of itself who the declarant is here. If you know. Now, under the adopted admission, you can take an affirmative action to adopt a statement that's not otherwise, where a declarant is not otherwise named as your own. You can do that by saying, I got the chicken sandwich as opposed to I got the hamburger, so to speak, to the extent that might be relevant. But we don't have that here. We simply have the existence of the declaration at a place where the defendant had control, dominion and control. And it seems to me it would be quite a stretch, and I noticed in your brief you didn't cite any authority from any other jurisdiction, federal or state, that suggests that adoptive admissions go that far. And so you want us to break new ground here with not a lot to frankly go on.
Do you have a couple cases with respect, Your Honor, that I've cited in my brief that I think do go this far? One's out of the Eighth Circuit. It's United States versus Marino. And there's a second case as well that basically in both of these cases, and I'm not remembering the second one off the top of my hand.
I remember them, and I compliment you on your brief.
Yes, Your Honor.
I do. Excellent brief.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. So the two cases from other jurisdictions have gone so far as to say that mere possession of a document of this sort is admissible as an adoptive admission to the hearsay rule. And I think it's important in this context to distinguish between different types of documents. This is not a letter written to Mr. Hall accusing him of a crime or implicating him in a crime. I do not think the rule that I'm asking for today would or should apply to that sort of a statement. Because there are additional reliability concerns you have to worry about where you have someone making a statement that at the time that it's made implicates someone in a crime.
We need to reach this issue anyway.
I don't think you need to reach this issue anyway. I think given the fact, I think the court can. I don't think the court is bound to do a harmless error analysis as opposed to the hearsay issue. I think both of them are strong arguments. And it's not a constitutional case, so there's no constitutional avoidance question. What's that, Your Honor?
No constitutional issue raised, either.
Correct. Well, and there couldn't have been because it was not testimonial at the time it was made, because it didn't implicate him in a crime.
Just as a matter of some interest, the Commonwealth argued, I believe in closing argument, hey, this receipt shows he got the bullets.
Actually, Your Honor, with respect, the Commonwealth went out of its way to say we are not relying on the bullet. And I've got a point I'd like to make about the bullet, because the bullet, I would argue, cannot even factor into the harmless error analysis because the defense introduced the bullet into evidence. The Commonwealth decided not to use the bullet because it was found in the wall 4 months after the fact. And so I would argue that's akin to approbate and reprobate. So in terms of the harmless error analysis and the probative value of the receipt, I think we can only look at the shell casing, which was found in the trash bag. And if I cut Your Honor off, I'm sorry, I'll let you finish.
In any event, suppose the Commonwealth had made no argument concerning the receipt, just introduced it in evidence.
Right, right.
Period. This was found in his car, and boom.
If that had happened, you could make an argument that it was used not for the truth of the matter asserted. But normally in those cases, you're just introducing a document to tie someone to the scene of the crime, for example. There's no reason to tie Mr. Hall to his car, so that analysis doesn't fit in this case. But yes,
just to be clear about it, we measure these things from the time the error is allegedly made, which would have been the admission of the evidence. So, had the Commonwealth proffered the receipt and said we're not offering this for the truth of the matter asserted, just for what the fact that ammunition was purchased by someone on that date. we wouldn't be having this discussion right now.
Okay, I stand corrected. But the way that this played out, there was no reason to tie him to the car.
They used it for hearsay.
Right. But I'd like to make just a couple of quick points about the receipt itself and its probative value. The only thing that opposing counsel relies upon to say it had great probative value was a statement made by the trial court halfway through the trial about it having strong probative value. I've got a few points on that. First of all, this was a jury trial, not a bench trial, so we care about what the jury thought about the weight of the evidence and not as much about what the court thought since it was not a bench trial. Secondly, the point I made earlier, the fact that we're only looking at really the shell casing and the hearsay and the harmless error analysis and not the bullet. And then when you look at the shell casing, in order to determine whether this receipt was cumulative in its effect, you have to ask, was there anything else that tied Mr. Hall to that spent shell casing in the trash bag? And of course, we also have Mr. Hall's DNA inside of Mr. Britt's wallet, which was in the trash bag.
There's a mountain nearby.
Right, exactly. So there was significant amount of evidence tying him to the spent shell casing without the receipt. So for all of those reasons, the admission of the receipt was harmless error. And finally, I'll close with this, which is a question I asked myself many times in preparing. The overwhelming evidence established that Mr. Hall had the motive to commit the crime, he had the means to commit the crime, and he also went to great lengths to clean up the mess. And just looking at the efforts he took to clean up the mess, what is the possible reasonable hypothesis of innocence that would explain the great lengths he went to clean up a crime scene? I couldn't come up with one. And I think unless you can come up with that hypothesis of innocence to send back to the trial court, this was harmless error, and there's no reason to do that here. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. Ms. Powers.
Just a couple of comments here. First, as to the case that the Attorney General has spoken about in Marino, that was the airline case, airline tickets, clearly being purchased by someone to go someplace. The case also says they were found with other documents connecting the tickets to the defendant, and they were in his possession. So we've got other things that make Marino a little bit different. So I'm not really concerned about Marino.
In that case, they were in his physical possession,
And there were other documents with it that were definitely linked to him. So I'm not sure that Marino really advances the argument here too much. As to what the judge in the case said at trial, that it was had strong probative value, this receipt, I agree that we're not talking about what the judge thinks, but what the jury thinks. But I'm believing that as men that have tried cases and tried cases, you understand that most of the time the judge has a pretty fair idea of what the jury is thinking. If he thinks it's strong evidence and is willing to say that on the record, I believe he thinks that the jury believes that's strong probative evidence. And so I think it is damaging evidence. It is not harmless because he thinks it is important evidence.
Well, now,
and singling it out above all the evidence, 120 plus pieces of evidence.
The question is not whether or not the evidence that may have been erroneously admitted is damaging. The question is the remaining evidence sufficient to render that damage harmless?
I think that when you look at all this case, if you put all that other evidence here, it is a bad situation for my client, Mr. Hall. It is a very bad situation, and I don't want to be sitting in his seat when that evidence is all concluded. But when you put this one last piece to it, it just, in a sense, for the Commonwealth, is tying a bow on the package, and now we have a link. We're going to connect him to this missing murder weapon. All this unspoken stuff that goes on in trial is a missing murder weapon, and so we want to convict on that. Three things real quickly. There was no signature on the receipt.
Now, excuse me. You say this is the murder weapon?
No.
Where does the Commonwealth argue that?
I said there is a silent implication. There's this implication because of all of this that there must be some murder weapon. They never said that, but the clear implication in the whole trial is that some kind of murder weapon is going. Why introduce a receipt for ammunition if that's not what you want to imply? This was an innuendo trial, but if I could just make three last points.
If you could do it in 20 seconds or so?
Less than 20 seconds. No fingerprints on the receipt. They had fingerprints everywhere, but no fingerprints on the receipt, no DNA on the receipt. And if he was, as the Attorney General says, so careful in cleaning up the crime scene, how could he have left this receipt in his car? It doesn't make sense. And I believe that this was the tipping point, harmful error, and should have been excluded.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We're going to come down and recount.